The Tom Woods Show, episode 1178.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, learn the history and economics they kept from you over at libertyclassroom.com, my flagship site. Learn from me and from other folks you can trust all the stuff they left out. Check it out at libertyclassroom.com and grab yourself a coupon at libertyclassroom.com/coupons. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. Our old friend John Tamney is back, and he's got a brand new book called The End of Work, Why Your Passion Can Become Your Job. And that sounds like the kind of topic I would cover in one of my bonus entrepreneurial episodes, but there's so much economics packed in here that I thought it was more appropriate to make it into a regular episode. John is editor of RealClearMarkets.com and political economy editor at Forbes. John, welcome back.
Hey, Tom, thanks for having me.
John, I'd like to start off with a one-minute elevator pitch from you for your book, The End of Work.
Well, my story is that I don't think people can be happy unless they're working hard. Warren Buffett could write all of us a check such that we would never work again for the rest of our lives, but that would not make us happy. And so what I'm describing in the book is an evolution of work. More and more people get up each day and get to do something that they love, that is an expression of their unique skills and intelligence. And so I think we're headed toward a happier society precisely because people are doing work that doesn't feel like work. It's more and more about what elevates them uniquely. And so my story is a very optimistic one. I think work is going to get better and better simply because it's going to elevate what's unique in all of us.
All right. Now, that's actually a very controversial thing to say because, of course, the mainstream position that we hear from a lot of outlets is that things are bound to get more and more miserable for people. And whether that's because of automation or whatever other trends, the bottom line is we're told that things are going to keep getting worse, particularly for people at the bottom of the ladder. So we're going to get to that in a minute. But if what you're saying is correct about positive trends, what do you think is driving this?
I account for it with wealth creation. And I account for it with the technology that has relentlessly destroyed jobs. Let's remember that 150 years ago when you were born, you kind of knew what your life was going to be. There was no such thing of thinking, hey, this is what I'd like to do when I grow up. You knew what you were going to do as soon as you were able. You were going to work 6 days a week on the farm. It didn't matter if you loved it or hated it. That was your future. And then robots like the tractor and the backhoe and fertilizer came along that made it possible for more and more food to be created with fewer and fewer hands. And it put more people out of work in theory than any advance in the history of mankind. But as opposed to putting us into breadlines, all it did is it freed us up to direct our talents at things that we were actually interested in. And so we started to cure disease. We developed the automobile and the airplane and the computer and the Wi-Fi. And so with all of these advances that by definition destroy jobs, people were able to specialize. And when we're able to specialize, we're able to do work that kind of lifts us up, that is commensurate with our unique skills. And I see a world in which we're more and more going to get to divide up work with the rest of with people around the world. And better yet, we'll get to divide up work with robots. And what that means is we won't be out of work, but we'll get to actually do something that we love for a job.
John, you have a very good chapter in here on education and a lot of interesting stories about people who succeeded without formal education in their field. But I think a lot of people are going to dismiss this kind of argument as merely anecdotal, even though I know your argument goes deeper than that. But they'll look at cases like this and say, yeah, of course, you'll always have the outliers. But, you know, normal people are going to need the standard approach. What say you?
I think what's good about our side in general is we don't turn anecdote into statistic. It is interesting, of course, that Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys, one of the great all-time musicians, freely acknowledges not knowing how to read music, that the Beatles were too poor to get a traditional musical education, can't read music, yet they became the Beatles, Rolling Stones, kind of the same idea. education doesn't matter. For music, you can still make it. But again, I agree that that's anecdotal. But then you look at a country like China. China is one of the least educated countries on earth. It's even less educated in nominal terms than Philippines. Yet once its people were economically free, they thrived. And so it's not in the book, but if you look at South Korea, it was one of the most illiterate countries in the world. But with economic freedom, its people thrived. And so I'm merely making the point that education is an effect of prosperity. We have all these amazing universities in the U.S. because we're the richest country on earth. We don't have all these amazing universities. We're not the richest country on earth because we have all these amazing universities. And so all I'm saying is that if you set people free, they'll thrive. The notion that school can prepare you for work presumes that professors can predict the future of work. And I find that laughable. If they could do that, they wouldn't be professors.
One of the points you make in your book is that the sheer variety we have, both as consumers and producers, is liberating. That is to say, as a producer of something, I have many different outlets that may be interested in it, as compared to in the past. So, for example, as a musician, well, I don't have to just be confined to a few record labels, and if I don't get a contract, that's the end of me. I have a lot of other options. That's true in the arts. It's true almost across the board. So, for example, you mentioned, by the way, the case of Breaking Bad, which I can't say is the single greatest television show of all time because I haven't watched all television shows, but all I can say is that it's the best television show I myself have ever seen. And I was fascinated to learn something I did not know before, namely that when Vince Gilligan approached HBO with this program, he did not even get a reply. He goes to FX, which is supposed to be known for quality programming. They pass on it, and in place of Breaking Bad, they put on Dirt. Anybody remember Dirt? So they go with Dirt, which goes nowhere and is, you know, nowhere to be seen any longer. But the point is, now that we don't just have three television networks, there was somebody out there that would take Breaking Bad.
Absolutely. And for those of you who haven't seen Dirt, don't, because I actually did TiVo it. It was Courtney Cox's next project after Friends, and it was just awful. FX, which has a very good track record of picking shows, did turn down Breaking Bad. HBO, which picked The Sopranos and picked The Wire, even though The Sopranos had been turned down by the big three networks, you know, whiffed on Breaking Bad. And so the rest is history. But that is the point. Whereas it used to be you had to please three networks in order to get your show aired. Nowadays, the path to getting a show on air, it grows all the time. It's not just the networks. Everyone knows you have Netflix, you have Amazon, you have Hulu, you have all these different ways to get your shows out there. And so the consumer benefits, but for those who want to make a life of art, who want to make television shows, your path to getting something made grows by the day. This is true in music too. When Keith Richards, when the Rolling Stones were coming up, if you got studio time, you couldn't believe it. This was all too rare. It was expensive. No one could do it. You'd almost made it at this point. Now, if you are a band, you can make an album with your iPhone. And this is increasingly true for those who want to make TV shows. And so the path to doing work that you love and the ability to get financing for it has exploded. We're creating more television shows in the United States than we ever have before. So those who love it could have a chance to make this a career, whereas they wouldn't have come close several decades ago.
I want to just read a quick passage from the book along these lines. You say, "What explains this revolution in entertainment? Look at your mobile phone. Back in 1989, a Tandy 5000 desktop computer, touted as the, quote, most powerful computer ever, cost $8,499, monitor and mouse not included. The smartphone in your pocket today would have qualified as a supercomputer then, if they could have built it, which they couldn't. The technological advances make programs easier to consume, of course, but they also make it easier to produce, lowering the barriers to entry in the entertainment business. More directors, writers, and actors will get to pursue their passion. That's an interesting overall point to take away. And then you elaborate on that in the next chapter, because the next chapter is called Abundant Profits Make Possible the Work That Isn't. And one example that you can draw from that chapter involves symphony orchestras. For a long time, if you played an instrument in an orchestra, it had to be some hobby on the side, and you had to balance your practice against all the other demands on your time, including your full-time work. And it was stressful and difficult. But now you have, with the increased creation of wealth and you have all the charitable giving that takes place as a result of that, you now have symphony orchestras that have been endowed to the point that people who otherwise would have been in a line of work that could not support a full-time living, nevertheless, now are able to make full-time incomes because they've been endowed by people who want to be patrons of the arts. And this has happened in the private sector, by and large.
All in the private sector. And isn't it interesting how the robber barons that history sometimes looks askance at, all that wealth created in the early part, late 19th, early 20th century, led to a scenario whereby millions and millions of dollars were given to orchestras. Orchestras were created rather quickly with this. It used to be, as you say, that if you wanted to play violin, if that was your passion, you could do that, but you were going to have another job. Nowadays, players in these orchestras around the country, even though it's not a profitable industry at all, in fact, it's very unprofitable, are able to earn frequently in the six figures. They travel the world. They have 10 weeks of vacation a year. They are literally paid to do something that they love uncontrollably and do it for a full-time job. And this is all thanks to wealth creation. These jobs didn't exist before. And so every time the stock market rises, every time the economy grows, nonprofit entities continue to grow themselves such that people who want to make a life out of art or making music can do exactly that. And this is such a modern late 20th, 21st century concept, and it's a beautiful one.
I was rather struck, especially in light of the taxes people have to pay, even though they have to pay those taxes, and even though they're told that those taxes go to perform charitable works and they go to support the arts and things. So you would think people wouldn't think it's necessary for them to make these donations because, as the saying goes, I gave it the IRS. But all the same, in your book, you note that private American giving could more than finance the entire annual GDP of Sweden, Norway, or Denmark. That's not nothing.
It's not nothing, and it speaks to something unique about the United States. You talk about a country that doesn't need all of the government spending. And my point there is that Americans are the most giving, compassionate people on earth. They just can't give it away fast enough, and there are even arguments that they give away too much, that the money would be better invested. That's a different argument from this one, but it does show you what the future is going to be like. There are many things that I think are going to come to be, and I think one of them is the four-day work week is rapidly descending on us, but precisely because all this wealth is being created, more and more people, if they choose, will be able to escape for-profit work. If they desire to work in an orchestra or work for a charity, they can do it for life and they can live a very nice life. The explosion of work, the explosion of wealth enables all sorts of people to do the kind of work that they never imagined before. Let's be clear, private charitable work is a very American concept. It's not something that you find in a lot of other countries. And figure we've only scratched the surface. If you look at who's rich today compared to who was rich 40 years ago, the team picture has changed a lot. And so what does that tell you 40 years from now, the amount of wealth in this country that will be chasing charitable advances is going to be stunning. And so people who want that kind of work, if you stay out of the way of wealth creation, your ability to have the kind of job that you love will explode before your eyes in very positive fashion.
You take a digression at one point in the book to talk about your own story and how it fits into this general thesis. And so I'd like to pause in our discussion of this for you to say a little something about your story.
Well, yes, I wanted people to realize that I'm not just talking about the rise of jobs that don't feel like work and just saying, okay, this is what's going to happen. I'm living my story. I used to work on Wall Street and I liked the job, but I didn't love it. And I quite honestly thought I was lazy. I would watch people who were passionate about equities every day. And I thought, I can't beat these people. This is not my passion. My passion was always economic policy, but I didn't see a path. And the internet came to fruition of sorts while I was in Wall Street, and it also busted at least for a time while I was there. And that led to me being laid off by Goldman Sachs. I don't run away from that. Failure is the path to fulfillment, I think, for many people. But the important point there is that the internet bust that made my employment on Wall Street more tenuous also set the stage for me doing what I love. Again, I thought I was lazy until I got into writing. And then I discovered a work ethic that I never realized I had. It's nothing for me to work all weekend. It's nothing for me when my baby is napping to take that precious free time and write up a column or sometimes two columns because I love it uncontrollably. And I'm just saying, I'm using all me as an example to say that I don't think anyone lacks work ethic because I used to think I lacked it. I don't think anyone lacks intelligence. But in a slower, less evolved economy, the ability for people to showcase their unique skills and intelligence is very limited. But whereas in a growing economy, our ability to do what elevates us uniquely explodes in positive fashion. And so I think I am a living definition of the end of work. I think you are too. You and I get to do something that we love uncontrollably for a job. And I can't begin to tell the listeners how lucky I feel I am. And I just feel like this is going to be more and more true for more and more people, such that they too will show up for work thinking, yes, I can't wait to get there because I'm about to do something that I love.
What is the scenario in which this development really applies to the least fortunate? I actually know a free market economist who shall remain nameless, who when asked, in this new economy, what will the lower skilled, less educated people do? And his answer was, less. What do you say?
I 100% disagree. I think in the economy that we're describing, these less educated people, these people on the fringe, are going to discover their genius in the way that people discovered their genius 100 years ago when they were freed from the farm. Let's be clear that I can't say this for you, but I can say it for me, that if my only path to eating were farm work, I would have been an object of pity. I would have been lazy and pathetic, and I would have been the one that they said, oh, what a loser. Oh, I would have been one of those people that your economist friend, who will remain nameless, was talking about. Warren Buffett has pointed out that if sports were his only path to achievement, he would be an object of pity. Well, of course. Fast forward to the present, the path to remunerative success or just fulfilling success, the path toward fulfilling work is endless. There are so many ways to make money. There are so many different jobs you can have. And so I think what's going to happen is everyone's got skills. I don't think anyone lacks work ethic. I don't think anyone is bad at everything. But a slow economy suffocates a lot of skills. I mean, again, 150 years ago, one of two odds, you were going to work on the farm. Think how many brilliant people that suffocated. And so with this massive growth, with the automation of all these dreary forms of work, the ability of individuals without education to showcase their unique talents is going to skyrocket. In fact, my book is about the people who won't get into Harvard or Yale or anything for most. It's the people who have great skills, but who in the past couldn't showcase them.
What about the question that's hanging over everyone's heads, the whole robot question? Robots are going to take my job. And you know what? Maybe they will. I don't think we can dispute that. Maybe robots will take your job. Why should I cheer that instead of wanting to take a sledgehammer to that robot?
Oh, let's hope robots destroy jobs en masse. Let's remember, the tractor is arguably the biggest job destroyer in the history of mankind, but it didn't put us into bread lines. Once again, it freed us up to focus our energies in more specialized ways. Open trade does not destroy jobs. It just allows us to divide up work. All of us know intuitively that when we divide up work, we're all made better off because we get to specialize. We get to do what we do best. Well, imagine what robots mean. Instead of two extra hands, they'll represent hundreds of hands and thousands of hands doing all the work that we didn't want to do and doing it 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Robots are going to make us fall in love with work as a result, simply because they are going to remove all that we hate from it. I have already pointed this out, that we're headed for a four-day work week. To me, that's just so obvious, and robots are going to be the driver of it. They're going to render us so much more productive that if we choose, we will work 4 days a week. And so this is the brilliance of this. It means that the demand for entertainment is going to go through the roof. And what that means is the kid who grew up who's only interested in video games, who had no interest in school, is going to be a superstar. The kid who had no interest in school and got tattoos but always had a fascination with food will become a charismatic person in the kitchen, serving the needs of the people who have endless entertainment wants and who finally get to express them in the marketplace because they're earning so much, but they also have more free time that they'll want to use to entertain themselves. So no, robots are going to be amazing. Just as the tractor was the original ultimate robot, this modern automation is going to turn the people who are viewed as poor and underclass and undereducated, they will be the next superstars because they'll finally have an avenue to showcase their skills.
Well, I think the way I've thought about it is that in some areas, it's pointless to try to compete with the robots. What robots are good at is doing a lot of rote things and, let's say, doing calculations really fast, and things that involve a lot of repetition and involve mental energy that we can't possibly match. But what robots are not good at is human contact and human qualities and interaction with other people. In other words, the kinds of work that we do that really is the most fulfilling, in which we really are interacting with other people and we're making an emotional connection with other people. Nobody wants a robot for that. And so it's been argued that with the introduction of robots, yes, we will shed some jobs, but they're the most dehumanizing jobs. They're the ones that least require what is uniquely human about us, and therefore will encourage the further development of jobs that do encourage what's human about us. Is that how you see it?
Oh, absolutely. But even bigger, let's hope that robots destroy hundreds of millions of jobs. Can you imagine what we'll get to do at that point? You know, Hazlitt put it best. He used to say, when idiot economists would say there's too much capital, what was his line that I can't believe even the ignorant would believe this? Implicit in this notion of robots putting us out of work is that we're going to run out of problems to solve, of diseases to cure, of ways to meet human needs. Oh my goodness, we haven't come close to this. And so just as the car and the computer and Wi-Fi made us much more effective humans, imagine if we've got these multiple hand concepts saving us, again, from, as you say, all these dehumanizing forms of work. They are going to make geniuses out of all of us. And to be fair, they're also, for those who are disabled, they are going to make them able. Let's be clear, 200 years ago, you and me, with our given skills, were in many ways very disabled. And then technology made us able to do lots of things. For those who lack our human abilities today, think of what the robots will do for them. They will make people on the outside more able to be on the inside, doing things, enhancing the human condition, simply because dead, old forms of work were erased. We were saved from doing them such that we could all be experts. There's certain things I can't do. There's certain things you can't do. Robots will save us from that and make us better. people are going to fall in love with their jobs if robots fulfill their promise.
I feel like there's still going to be a lot of skepticism there. I think you still have a long row to hoe because it's hard for people to see this. You know, you quote Hazlitt, but one of the points Hazlitt makes repeatedly is that it's hard for people to see with their mind's eye. They can see only with their physical eyes. And with their physical eyes, they see robots are displacing people from their traditional lines of work. That's what their physical eyes are telling them. But you're asking them to think with their mind's eye, and that's a bit of a problem.
I think you're very right, and I've actually had the most difficult time in discussing this book is people keep saying, well, what about all the displaced workers? And what I keep saying, but I'm trying to get people to think differently on this one, is that there are rarely displaced workers in the parts of the world where jobs are being destroyed most rapidly. It's in the parts of the U.S. and around the world where jobs aren't being destroyed, where workers are most displaced. I mean, think about it. Aliquippa, PA was not wrecked because the steel mills shut down. Aliquippa, PA was wrecked because the steel mills stuck around. And talented people who are the magnet for investment that leads to company creation and job creation don't want to work in steel mills. New York City used to be the number one manufacturing city. Were its peoples displaced? No. The fact that factory jobs departed there most rapidly, such that Google now populates the old Nabisco factory and old glass factories or restaurants, is why New York is so ahead, why it attracts so much talent to this day. And so my broad point here is that, and so you look at Silicon Valley, here's another example. It's the biggest, it's where jobs are destroyed most rapidly. And what do you see there? People who have no technological skills have the greatest odds of finding work. They can work as baristas. They can work as personal trainers. They can work as yoga instructors, doctors, lawyers, sommeliers, chefs. There's a bidding war for chefs in Silicon Valley. The list is long. My point is, where jobs are being destroyed the quickest is where the opportunity is endless. What should concern us is the parts of the world and country where robots are not revealing themselves, because those are the ones that are going to be in big trouble. And I think Bastiat put this well in his political economy stuff, as he said, show me the parts of the world that don't have lots of technology. Those are the poor ones, aren't they? I mean, he put it much better, but it's where there isn't job destruction, where people are most bad off.
Well, I'm going to leave it there because I want people to go and read this book. It's a fun book to read, by the way. You make very, very important, sometimes even profound points, but you do so in a way that's so entertaining and so chock full of modern examples that are so fascinating. In fact, I sat there thinking, how does he know so much about all these aspects of popular culture? You knew things about the Beatles, and I've been a crazy Beatles fan since I was a kid, that I didn't know. I thought, what the heck? This is just one area. This guy seems to know all the. But you put all that together, it makes it like you don't even notice the pages going by. So the book is The End of Work, Why Your Passion Can Become Your Job. I'm linking to it for this episode. This episode is number 1178, so it's linked at tomwoods.com/1178. John, any website you'd like to plug while you're here?
Sure, Tom. Thank you so much. You do such a great show, and I thank you for being so gracious about my book. I do love it, and I love pop culture. I think it can explain all of economics. But realclearmarkets.com. You can find a lot of my stuff. You can find me at Forbes.com, and of course, you can buy several copies of this book on Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble. If I can just throw in there that it's for parents and kids. It's for parents who are worried that their kids don't have focus. My point is we live in an economy where if you have a passion, there's a remunerative job associated with it. And for kids who just are bored to tears, this will show you the explosion of jobs that don't feel like work. People now make money playing video games. It's amazing the different ways you can make money today. So thank you so much for having me on.
They definitely should. Basically ambitious young folks and their parents should both read this book. Again, it's not heavy with economic analysis. It's you sneak it in there so that people almost don't even notice it. Very, very well done. So again, best of luck with this project and with your ongoing work, and thanks for your time.
Thank you.
All right, folks, that's going to do it for today. I want to just say to all you good folks out there who are regular listeners that I appreciate you. I appreciate that you listen regularly. I appreciate all you folks who spread the word about the show through word of mouth or social media. You share episodes of the show on social media or on blogs and things of that sort. I really, really appreciate that. You're helping me spread the word. And I think we're doing some good stuff here on this podcast, and I appreciate you helping me grow the audience. So a thank you to all you good folks. And if you are a new listener, then I urge you to subscribe to the show over at tomwoods.com/iTunes. Just click view in iTunes and then click that subscribe button. And I promise you, I'll be delivering you really good, solid material every single weekday. All right, see you later.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.